Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Depending on who you talk to, or perhaps who you hang out with, marijuana is either a gentle wonder drug that brings relief to glaucoma sufferers and sparks appetite in cancer patients, or an ambition-draining gateway drug that was wisely outlawed by the federal government decades ago and needs to be kept off our streets and out of our medicine cabinets. But what does the science say? The experts who would like to know are actually a bit behind their peers looking into the effects of other chemical substances, in part because laws passed in 1970 declared marijuana to have no legitimate medical use, making it very hard to study without violating federal law. But as my guest has discovered, relaxed medical marijuana laws in 23 states and in other countries have created a sort of research renaissance, and scientists are indeed learning many interesting things. Journalist Hampton Sides wrote the cover story for the June issue of National Geographic. It's called High Science, and it's about the claims and evidence for the use of marijuana as medicine. Hampton, welcome back to Think.
It's great to be back with you.
Before the modern era of criminalization, how have different cultures used marijuana as medicine or for its psychotropic effects?
Well, it goes way back. I mean, it's as old as it's older than writing. Certainly ancient civilizations like China and India were using cannabis as part of their pharmacopoeia. It was used in the United States, actually, legally in all kinds of tinctures and extracts. Some of them probably not very effective, but certainly it was part of considered a legitimate medicine up until the 1930s in the United States when it was outlawed, and then we entered the age of reefer madness and the perception that this was a gateway drug and the assassin of youth and everything else. And so, you know, for the last 70 years or so during that period, it was really difficult to learn anything about this plant. Even while we were learning about, you know, opiates and a wide range of other drugs, this common plant that humanity is practically, you know, grown up with over millennia was in the dark. So anyone who was advancing knowledge about cannabis during that period was essentially a criminal. And consequently, really the only information that we were getting about really what's in the plant, what are the compounds, what works, what doesn't, was coming from overseas in a few pockets, a few countries where it was allowed to be studied.
Much of what we've known until recent years could be attributed to the work of this Bulgarian chemist working in Israel. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, he's one of the gentlemen that I profile in the piece. He's the patriarch of cannabis research. Back in the 1960s in Israel, he decided to peer into the chemical structure of the plant. No one had really seriously done that before, even though they'd certainly done it with other plants plants that produce powerful drugs. He just thought it was curious. Here's this plant grows all over the world, and no one really knew what was in it or what caused this psychotropic, the psychoactive ingredient, whatever that was. So he started looking into it, and he's an amazing man, by the way. He's in his 80s now. He doesn't smoke pot. He says he's never touched this stuff ever, not even once. He's a very serious chemist, and he was the gentleman who first isolated THC and began to recognize that it was the principal psychoactive ingredient in cannabis. And his research spawned a lot of other research and finally put cannabis science on the map as a legitimate discipline. I think a lot of people, particularly in the United States, serious scientists were reluctant to study the plant because it would tarnish their reputation. It was not considered serious. And a lot of this had to do with what you alluded to earlier, the federal position on the drug. As a Schedule I drug, it was not only illegal, but perceived and declared to have absolutely no medical value. So here this gentleman in Jerusalem, and of course, Israel's a place. When I was over there interviewing him, there was there was a lot of violence in the headlines. There was a lot of activity in Gaza, and I was just thinking the whole time, this is one country that could probably use use like a lot of marijuana right now, you know, just to chill out. But ironically, Israel is the country that has the most advanced medical marijuana program. There are hundreds of thousands of patients who have licenses and are taking marijuana in a medical environment for all kinds of ailments. So it's sort of become a laboratory for the claims and counterclaims, some of them specious claims, of cannabis's effects on people who are suffering from various diseases.
Were you able to get a handle, Hampton, on exactly what happened in the 30s that made people so afraid of marijuana in particular? I've seen that film, Reefer Madness.
Mm-hmm. Reefer Madness, yes.
It's really comical to look at it now. If you've ever actually seen a person who's using marijuana, they don't behave like the people in Reefer Madness.
It doesn't hold up right. I mean, the claims of that movie were that you went on murderous rampages. It made you violent. It made you it almost like hopped up like crystal meth or something. Anyone who smokes pot or knows people who do knows that most people just kind of vegetate in a couch and eat Doritos. So it's really hard to understand. It has when you delve into the history of cannabis and the history of the legality of cannabis, you get very quickly into a number of conspiracy theories, which I think have some validity. One of them is that leading tycoons who were in charge of things like the paper industry didn't want hemp, industrial hemp, which is kind of the sister to cannabis. It's essentially the same plant, but it doesn't have any THC in it. It produces this amazing fiber, which can be used for paper, for cloth, for rope, for you name it. And one of the theories you'll hear is that essentially the pulp industry, the tree, like companies like Weyerhaeuser, were violently opposed to hemp because it was such an effective plant for producing fiber like this. So you get pretty quickly into these conspiracy theories about what people in authority were scared of. This plant grows all over the world. It is it grows in ditches. It seems to kind of survive and thrive in any kind of ecosystem. So you're right to point that out. It's just very curious that all this fear was generated by the federal government. It all came down to this one guy named Anslinger who really led the campaign. He was sort of the J. Edgar Hoover of drugs. And he was the one who lumped it into the same category as heroin and these other highly toxic, highly addictive, dangerous drugs. I think that what's happened over the last 70 years is that people have come to realize that their own experience with this plant does not jibe with what they've been told by the federal government. It's not highly addictive. It is not toxic. As intoxicants go, it's quite mild. That's not to say it's not a drug. It is a drug, especially the stuff that's coming out of Colorado these days. But it's a curious phenomenon for sure.
Do you think that the medical marijuana industry hurts itself in some ways? I went online before the show today, and I was looking at dispensaries in California, right, which are legal, mm-hmm. and you can get a prescription and go in there. And they still have products. You know, like if I have a backache and I go to the pharmacy to fill a prescription, nothing behind that counter is called Purple Punch or Animal Cookies or Diesel Dog.
Ebola, the names of these strains are Kim Dog.
Right.
You know, they're... Yeah, you mean the kind of disconnect between the claims and the way these things are being kind of sold and marketed?
If you want it to be treated as serious medicine, let's not call it by these kind of winky titles.
I think it'll catch up. I think that the truth of the matter is in California, especially, you have essentially a recreational industry buried in a medical industry. And that's really one of the reasons why Colorado separated the two, because a lot of those people in California, and I have friends who are in this demographic, you know, they just want to smoke pot. And so they claim they have a backache or, you know, whatever. And they find a doctor who will write the script and they'll get the stuff. Right. And it's an abuse of the system, and it's the real reason why we need to separate the two categories.
I was surprised to learn that marijuana has been used with some success in certain cases to treat asthma. That seems like such a disconnect.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. And in Israel, it's been studied a good bit. And this guy, Rafael McCullum, the scientist that I interviewed there, talked at some length about it. It seems to have some very powerful effects as a bronchodilator. And again, we have not studied it in the United States. We're not allowed to study this in clinical trials. It needs to be looked at. And unless and until the government reschedules marijuana from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 2 or perhaps deschedules the drug, I don't think you'll ever see any real serious longitudinal, you know, placebo-controlled clinical trials for asthma or any other ailment. It's a really difficult, you know, it's like 800-pound gorilla in the room, the federal government's position on this. And until the gorilla leaves the room, a lot of scientists are just, you know, gonna let countries like Israel do the work.
And even the places where medical marijuana sales are allowed, like banks don't want to do business with people who have legitimate state-authorized dispensaries.
Yeah, I live part of the year in Colorado. I teach at Colorado College. And you see this all the time. It's a real problem. The dispensaries and all the grows and all the everyone connected with this business has to deal strictly in cash. To meet their payroll, to purchase things. Let's say they have to buy pipe or lumber from Home Depot for their grows. They have to pay in cash. They can't have a credit card. They can't have a checking account because the FDIC is a federal agency, and banks who participate in this kind of activity essentially, you know, laundering drug money, I guess you could say. It's legal in Colorado, of course, but it's still a federally illegal drug. So that's why you have all these people running around with guns, protecting giant wads of cash. I went to one of the grows in Denver where they have a money counting machine, and it was payroll time, and they were, you know, the employees were showing up. They have over 80 employees, and they were getting their check essentially in the form of hard, cold cash. It was kind of a curious thing to see. And until that changes, I think, you know, one of the great fears is that it's still, even though it's legal, it has all the patina of an illicit business. And there's always the fear of violence, of burglaries, of people getting shot on the street, and all the things that go with the drug cartels and the kind of the old perception of the drug.
And does the Drug Enforcement Agency just sort of let that activity go in the states where medical marijuana growing is authorized?
I think I'm not an expert on sort of all the legalities of this, but there are a number of lawsuits that have been filed against Colorado essentially suggesting that it's unconstitutional, that the federal government is refusing to crack down on what's happening, this great experiment, if you want to call it, in Colorado and Washington State. These are particular border states like Nebraska, Kansas, Utah, who are not happy with what's happening in Colorado, and they want the federal government to kind of reverse its position. Because right now the federal government is basically just taking a laissez-faire position. Let this experiment go and see where it leads.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Hampton Sides. His article, High Science, is about medical marijuana research, and it is the cover story of the June issue of National Geographic magazine. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Hampton Sides. His article about research into the medical effects of marijuana is called High Science, and it appears in the June issue of National Geographic. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think at kera.org. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So Hampton, McCullum, is that how you say his name?
Yes.
Identified
well,
this.
Actually, you know, he's Israeli, so you actually have to kind of hawk up a loogie to say it correctly. McCullum, something like that. But yes.
All right. Well, with apologies to Professor McCullum. Anyway, I'm sorry for butchering his name, but he identified tetrahydrocannabinol, THC. He also discovered another compound in marijuana that does not affect moods or cognitive function called CBD, cannabidiol.
Yes.
What are the potential uses for that?
Cannabidiol is really the component of the plant that I think most scientists and most medical specialists are most excited about. It is not psychoactive. It is, you know, this plant has some ridiculous number of compounds, something like over 80, possibly over 100 cannabinoids. It has terpenes and flavonoids and all this stuff in it. And it is some curiosity, like why does the plant produce all this stuff? What does it benefit from all this, all these different suites of compounds? But this CBD is the one that I think has excited the world more than anything because now you've probably heard about the families who've moved to Colorado Springs whose children are suffering from multiple neurological disorders and resulting in seizures. And this strain that's called Charlotte's Web, which is a high CBD, low THC drug that these children take as an oil. The active ingredient is CBD. And we do not understand the mechanism of action, but it clearly binds to certain receptors in the brain and can, in some cases, and I hasten to add, it is not a miracle drug. It doesn't work for everybody who has seizures or epilepsy. But it clearly does work and is quite effective for a large percentage of these patients. And it seems to regulate neurological activity. And it, if it works for this, then, you know, all sorts of a broad range of neurological disorders could be affected. There could be benefits with CBD. So I think what you're going to see in terms of the science is a real concentration in the years ahead on CBD, on isolating CBD, synthesizing it, creating various kinds of compounds and drugs. Of course, the pharmaceutical companies are trying to get into this, and for them to do it and patent it, they've got to kind of change the chemical structure a little bit and do what they do, which is, you know, it's always you know, the plant's not good enough. They've got to change it and make it their own. But they will, and they've already begun to do that. And I think you'll see a lot of really interesting science coming out of CBD research.
Some head shops here in Dallas have come under investigation lately for allegedly distributing synthetic marijuana. How do synthetic forms of the drug compare with cannabis compounds derived from plants? And forgive me, because I know this is not in your piece, but I wonder if you looked into this.
Well, there have been various attempts to synthesize marijuana, make synthetic marijuana. And the key ingredient for head shops and for most people around the world traditionally has been THC, right? It's the chemical that gets you high. And it's very similar. McCullum did that back in the 1960s. He made synthetic THC and found that it was quite effective in mimicking what the real plant does. But he also talks about this really interesting phenomenon he calls it the entourage effect. And that is that in all these attempts to synthesize and isolate a single compound like THC, it doesn't seem to be as effective as the real plant itself in treating all kinds of ailments. There seems to be something in the combined effects of all those 80-plus cannabinoids and all the terpenes and flavonoids and all this other stuff that's in there that's greater than the sum of its parts. So this effort of creating a synthetic THC may be misguided, or let's say synthetic CBD. There seems these various compounds work in tandem in some way.
It almost sounds like the argument that a lot of dietitians will make, that you're much better off eating a whole salad than taking five supplements that are supposed to give you the same vitamins and minerals.
Yeah. There's a little of that, and there is a movement that's starting to happen. You'll start hearing about something called the supplement movement in cannabis, which is this is kind of complicated, but McCollum also was instrumental, along with several other scientists, in figuring out that the brain essentially makes our own onboard cannabinoids, chemicals very similar to compounds you find in the plant, and they bind to these receptors, and it's a whole network. It's a neurological network, much like you would find with dopamine or serotonin. And there's going to be this kind of whole class of drugs, but also this notion that perhaps people who are suffering from various neurological problems may just simply have a deficiency. And that if you have a supplement, some sort of supplement that's non-psychoactive that you can take with your salad or with your cereal in the morning, like you might take flaxseed or whatever, that, some of these neurological disorders may go away. It's something that's being talked about more and more.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Richard in Dallas. Hello, Richard.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious your guests had any information on painkiller prescription overdoses and states that have medical and recreational programs, if there's been a decrease at all. It seems like folks that are trying to break through maybe a pain, that are trying to chase and take a pill and then take another pill and take an additional pill and end up in an overdose state, where if they were able to maybe eat a little brownie or to maybe smoke a little marijuana to be able to break through and save themselves from an ER trip or from the grave. I was just curious.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I don't have any hard data on that, but there's no question that medical marijuana, at least anecdotally, but I mean, it's sort of, you're going to hear the word anecdotal a lot when you talk about cannabis, because the federal government doesn't allow you to study it. Yes. In terms of dealing with pain, there's no question that cannabis can help with all kinds of pain. And it is orders of magnitude, less addictive than opiates or OxyContin, oxycodone. And those are the kinds of things that, let's say, cancer patients are realizing, is that it's just a much more effective and much fewer side effects than traditional painkillers. So that's certainly one of the uses of the drug. And I don't, as far as hard statistics on what's happened in Colorado with regard to painkiller deaths and overdoses, I don't have that information. I'm sorry.
Because of all this anecdotal evidence, I'm curious how people who want to understand this are trying to get beyond the hype. I think about, the 19th century, when certainly there were things like laudanum, but even, a lot of tonics were really just alcohol and God knows what else.
Right,
you drink enough alcohol, your pain's going to feel a little bit better, but it's not necessarily good for you. How are people trying to understand how much of the purported benefits of marijuana for things like pain relief are simply attributable, not that it's necessarily a bad thing, but to the fact that marijuana gets you high?
Yeah, good question. I think there's no question. I think I have to separate two different things. One is that marijuana is clearly a palliative. Mm-hmm. It can help with suffering, like chemo patients, increasing appetite, helping with sleep, helping with pain, fighting nausea. Those are palliatives, right? I mean, it's not going to cure your cancer, although that is one of the profiles of my piece is a scientist in Spain who is beginning to research the use of THC as an anti-cancer agent. That's a whole other story. But overall, palliative is I don't think there's any question that it can be useful as a palliative. Now, how many of those people are just doing it because they want to get high? You know, that would be a very difficult one to sort out. And it's certainly a part of the puzzle. You know, it is it's an intoxicant. A lot of the people who advocate all this stuff seem to forget that. Like, yeah, it is an intoxicant, just like we drink alcohol. Societies throughout human history have sought after intoxicants for whatever reasons, ritualistic purposes, ceremonial. It is something that we as a species want. I think that a lot of the sort of pro-medical pot advocates often just sort of dance around that issue. It is an intoxicant. It does get you high. And, you know, you can ask the question, well, is that a bad thing? Or is it just part of human nature to seek those kinds of experiences? I sort of leave that up to it's almost a philosophical debate, I guess.
We think of marijuana as contributing to this feeling of relaxed euphoria. As you mentioned, it's an intoxicant. What do we know about why some people have what amounts to an opposite reaction? They feel depressed. They feel more anxiety than they would have otherwise.
Yeah. Well, I don't know exactly why, but there's no question about the fact that some people experience profound anxiety attacks. And although there in the literature there's not a single that I know of case of someone dying from marijuana overdose. It's almost impossible to overdose on marijuana. It can produce these anxiety attacks, which can cause heart attacks, which can cause bizarre behavior that can lead to your death. And I think it's really important to emphasize that, you know, this is a drug. It is a powerful drug. And in some people, it is a potentially lethal drug because of this phenomenon of creating these anxiety attacks. And there's some literature that indicates that marijuana can trigger can trigger schizophrenia in individuals who were clearly predisposed to develop schizophrenia. It can be a triggering event, one of these anxiety attacks that's produced by smoking pot. Some of this has to do with the extremely high THC levels in some of the strains that you're seeing now. So I think, you know, that's something I want to underscore, and both in the piece and in talking about it, is that we have to accept that, you know, marijuana is a fairly mild intoxicant in the scheme of things, but it, for certain people who are prone to anxiety attacks, it is it's a dangerous drug, and it needs to be treated carefully and avoided by certain kinds of people. So there's that factor in the whole puzzle.
Are the medicinal effects of marijuana, when it's used, you know, appropriately, subject to the development of tolerance over time, the same way the psychoactive effects are?
My understanding is yes. People who take it every day for whatever reason feel they need to take more every, especially when it comes to THC. And you do build up a tolerance. You have to take more and more to get the same effect. That seems to be true for most people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Mike in Fort Worth. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I had a quick question. I'm a physician in Fort Worth, and, one of the questions I have is, you mentioned that there's not a lot of research coming out on the federal level about marijuana, but, you know, take, for example, the University of Colorado is in a legal environment that could really expound on some of the current knowledge and see if there's any, I just want to see if there's any research projects or advanced research going on in Colorado specifically regarding some of these specific questions that we have that may or may not be federally funded.
Yeah. One of the profiles in my piece is of a gentleman named Nolan Kane, who is a geneticist. And he is at CU Boulder. He's leading this project to do the genome project on cannabis, peer into the genetic structure of this plant. And he has had to jump through so many hoops to do this legitimately. because Colorado, even though it's legal in Colorado, the University of Colorado Boulder is, like most institutions, highly dependent on federal funding, right? So he's been able to do this, but, I mean, he has had to dance a dance to get this project up and running. But there is there are a number of other folks associated with CU Boulder that are talking about starting an institute to kind of begin to codify all this research and everything that we do know. It is starting to happen. It's kind of like a startup industry, and everyone who's involved in it is peculiarly excited. It's like, you know, when I visited Dr. Kane's office, all these PhD candidates in there studying cannabis for the first time, you know, in a long, long time, they were able to seriously, you know, hold their head up and say we're studying and we're learning profound things about this plant, a plant that they were not allowed to study, you know, just a few years ago. So it's kind of an interesting time in the history of this plant.
It is peculiar that I think every U.S. state would allow, say, a cancer patient to access morphine, even though it's an opium derivative. But mm-hmm. Medicine made from marijuana is limited in a lot of states.
Yeah, I know. I mean, everyone knows that morphine is a seriously powerful drug and a very effective painkiller, but it's very addictive and very toxic, and you can overdose on it. And that disconnect is one of the things that I think this whole grassroots movement is about. It's like, you know, our experience with this drug does not match what you're telling us. It's as I've said several times, it is a drug. We have to respect it, but in the scheme of things, it's so much milder than opiates. And I think we're finally coming to realize that.
We're speaking with journalist Hampton Sides, who wrote the cover story for the June issue of National Geographic. It's called High Science. It's about medical marijuana research. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Hampton Sides about High Science, his article about medical marijuana research in the June issue of National Geographic magazine. You can join us on Twitter by finding me at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Hampton, why is marijuana good for glaucoma?
I have no idea. I don't understand that one either. It has been studied, particularly in Israel, and it seems to be very effective. The mechanism of action, you know, scientists and medical specialists and doctors want to understand not just that something works, but precisely how and why. We don't seem to fully understand it. There's some literature on it. It seems to be beyond question that it has some benefits for many, many patients with glaucoma. Why? How? This is why this is such an exciting field. All these things are now up for study, and serious scientists are now able to get funding to study these kinds of things. So this will be yet another area that we'll be hearing about, I think, you know, in the future. I think that, you know, what's so fascinating about this is that, you know, it's like, as Dr. Kane in one of the profiles says in the article, that, you know, science is generally incremental, but what we're having in cannabis science is a kind of transformational quantum leap in intelligence that we're gathering now as we make great strides in learning this stuff, and it's an exciting field for these scientists to be in.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org.
I was going to say one other thing, Chris. I was going to say that I think it's really a testament to kind of the seismic shift that's going on out there that National Geographic, of all magazines, is doing this story and doing it and putting it on the cover. Everyone, of course, by now has done their cannabis story, right? It's just like every newspaper and magazine and 60 Minutes and Sanjay Gupta. Everyone has done something on this in the last year or so. But the fact that National Geographic, a magazine that whose a large percentage of readers are elementary school libraries and little old ladies who collect the magazine down in their basement, you know, it says something about the changing times that we can talk seriously and think seriously about this plant. I think it's indicative of really what's going on around the world. And one of the reasons why I very, very readily and very gladly signed on to this assignment. It's an interesting time in our history that this shift has come about.
Are scientists able, even in this decriminalized environment, to look at the effect, ethically, to look at the effect of marijuana use on very young users? As we know, a lot of people who end up smoking marijuana as adults began as adolescents when their brains are not fully developed yet.
Right. Yeah. Now, that's something that comes up several times in my piece and came up a lot in my research. There seems to be very, very strong evidence that the prolonged smoking of particularly high THC strains of marijuana can affect the way your brain grows, literally the way the neurons develop. They can't absolutely say that it causes an aberrant growth in your brain that is particularly harmful. They haven't been able to particularly isolate in what way it's harmful, but there have been MRI studies that seem to show very clearly that marijuana can affect the way the young brain develops. And so, you know, this is a big part of the debate in talking about marijuana is like, how do we talk about it with our children? You know, I'm a father. I've got three boys. You know, marijuana is all around them. And if you tell a teenager you can't do something, of course he's going to do it anyway. But this is something that I bring up. The science does indicate that prolonged smoking of these really powerful strains can affect the way the brain develops. And so you got to be particularly cautious as a teenager in dealing with this. It's not a conspiracy theory. I know a lot of teenagers think it is. You know, there they go again. The authorities, they always have to tell us something is wrong until we're 18 or 21 or whatever. But there's ample evidence in the literature that there's something going on there.
Did you find a lot of scientists who study marijuana believe it's powerful enough that they don't use it recreationally?
With every scientist that I talked to, I eventually got around to asking, you know, to popping the question, do you smoke?
Yeah.
You know? And I think some of them were lying to me, honestly, when they said no, because of federal funding, because of their reputations, because of collegial opinions that they had to be careful about. Like McCullum, McCullum insists that he never has touched the stuff. Why would you spend your entire life studying a plant and not try it one time? I think that there's still a little bit of a stigma attached to it, even in Colorado, where, you know, you're not really breaking the law. I guess you're certainly breaking a federal law, but you're not breaking state law. And so I don't know. It's a interesting kind of question of almost like of hypocrisy, you know, like you study a plant, but you can't really be honest about whether you smoke it or not in certain scientific circles.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Kyle in Haslett. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thanks.
I just wanted to ask the the cast you had there about a disease, maybe, that I don't know if disease is the right word. It's called cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome. But just basically my experience recently, we took my girlfriend to the hospital in Fort Worth and had a couple of different ER visits that didn't really pan out with any results until one day we came back in with the same set of symptoms, which sounds like emesis vomiting, you know. And we had a very nice PA, not a doctor, who told us, hey, we can't really diagnose you with this because it's not in the DSM as of yet, but right, we are investigating cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, which typically, the PA told me, occurs in long-time users. So I was just interested to see if the guests had seen this non-existent disease in any other travel across the world.
No, that hasn't come up, actually. But so you're saying that prolonged users can have symptoms of where they're vomiting constantly, or they have nausea?
That I can't. Yeah, again, it's not a real disease according to the DSM, but they tried to diagnose my girlfriend with cyclic vomiting syndrome and a number of other different vomiting-based things until we got the PA to give us that tip. But she said, yes, typically in people who are using for long-term periods or who might be using concentrates will eventually see some sort of toxicity built up from. I'm not sure about if it's CBDs or THCs, but my girlfriend hasn't indulged in that for very many years, so it kind of presents an interesting case. Like, is there something, some sort of danger looking out there for long-term users or for concentrate users? But
yeah, I don't know. I'm sorry, I haven't heard of that, but and it goes against the grain of, you know, the popular use of marijuana as an anti-emetic, you know, among chemo patients, for example. Another area that needs to be studied. There's so many hundreds of thousands of studies that have been done on opiates, and the medical literature is bountiful, and that's what's going to happen with cannabis in the years ahead. We're going to, you know, anything and everything you can think of that can be studied will be studied by someone somewhere, and so hopefully we'll get to the bottom of this one as well.
Do you foresee a time in the United States when marijuana use is decriminalized at the federal level, or do you think that strain that we have that disapproves of the use of medication that causes us to be deliberately intoxicated will keep that from happening? Like, you can drink a glass of wine without the intention of becoming high, but you don't really smoke marijuana without the intention of becoming high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I do think that there are already a lot of little indications that the federal government will change the classification of the drug. That's not to say decriminalize it, but change it to Schedule 2.
What's the difference there? Like, how different is Schedule 1 from Schedule 2?
Well, Schedule 1 is the exact wording I can't remember, but it's something like a drug with a potential to be highly addictive, highly dangerous, and of no medical benefit.
Hmm.
That's what they're saying now. Schedule 2 is medical benefit. Yes, there's medical benefit, but it's a powerful drug that needs to be regulated and restricted and controlled. It's a controlled substance. Like so many of the drugs that are in hospitals, for example, they're controlled substances, but they're Schedule 2. So anyway, but your earlier question was, do we foresee a time when, when the whole country's perception will change and it will be decriminalized? Well, I don't know. I think decriminalization is sort of depends on how you define it. I do think that there is a widespread belief, and this cuts across party lines, is that the war on drugs in general has been a failure in terms of its cost to society, the unbelievable amount of money we spend incarcerating people in prisons all over the country for drug offenses. There's just a widespread belief, you know, that we have to do something different. We have to approach this plant somehow in a different way, because, you know, the war on drugs just ruined a lot of lives, cost society a huge amount of money, and didn't work because the demand was still there. And so I think that whether you're Republican or a Democrat, whether you're liberal or conservative, there is a groundswell of support for the idea of rethinking the whole legalities question. That's not to say it will be a shift in opinion that, you know, it should be completely legalized, but rather the sentencing would change, imprisonment, you know, different kinds of questions about how people are being imprisoned would change, and also the drug would be highly regulated, taxed, and studied, relentlessly studied. I think that's the thing that all the scientists are really advocating for.
Did you learn anything about attitudes toward marijuana in parts of the world where it literally is a weed? Like, I've heard that in Nepal it kind of grows by the side of the road and people are like, these Americans mm-hmm. are crazy mm-hmm. that they go insane when they see this plant and it's not that big a deal.
Yeah. Well, part of that is the mystique. I mean, if you say something is the assassin of youth and it's the killer, you know, it's a killer weed, it's reefer madness, and you tell generations of teenagers you can't go there, well, you create a mystique. And it, over there, there's no mystique. It's just there it is. You can smoke it or not. So that's part of it. I think that what we're seeing in Colorado is the mystique is going away. And a lot of teenagers and some of these kids that I teach in Colorado's college, they're kind of blasé about weed. You know, it's like, what's the big deal? Like, you know, it's like, it's just there it is. Take it or leave it. The mystique seems to be gone. And I think that's something that's kind of interesting. This plant is sort of kind of emerging into the light, and doesn't mean you have to smoke it or you want to smoke it. It just means that that whole mystique is evaporating. And I think it'd be interesting to see what happens in the years to come as that kind of happens around the country.
Has recreational marijuana been a good source of tax revenue for the state of Colorado? I know that the medical form is not taxed in the same way.
Yeah. It's unbelievable what's happening in Colorado. But you can't extrapolate everything from Colorado because it's one of the very few states that's done this. A lot of people come to Colorado to buy this stuff and then leave, right? If this becomes nationalized, then there'll be lots of Colorados. If you understand my meaning,
yeah.
But I can't remember how many. It's hundreds of millions of dollars in tax revenues, and you know it's being used to repave roads and build bridges and build back the infrastructure of Colorado. And it's been so successful that they're going to be getting a rebate next year. You know, kind of like Alaska gets every year a rebate from the
basically from oil right?
and gas revenues. So it's, like there's going to be this green subsidy that all the taxpayers are going to get next year. I think it's next year. There's no question about it from that point of view. And if a lot of other states are starting to look jealously and covetously at Colorado and how this revenue thing has generated, it's just generated so much.
Hampton Sides wrote the cover story for the June issue of National Geographic. It's called High Science, about the claims and evidence for the use of marijuana as medicine. Hampton, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. I so appreciate you making time for us.
Yeah, I love your show. I love being with you, and I really enjoyed it.
Thanks. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Today, Lindsay Connect produced the show. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.